Hello, I'm Eric Corman, League of Education Voters Communications Director, with Superintendent of Public Instruction candidate Chris Rakedaw. Chris was born and raised in Snohomish, Washington, and is the youngest of eight children. He attended Washington State University and was a classroom teacher before attending graduate school at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. After graduate school, Chris returned to Washington State, where he went to work for the state Senate. Chris served in the state legislature to create opportunities for learners of all ages by ensuring a robust and successful community and technical college system. As a former school board member, Chris understands that a seamless education system from early learning to higher education is needed to ensure that citizens have access to the best education, the best jobs, and the greatest opportunity to achieve self-actualization. More info at chrisreykdal.com, spelled chrisreykdal.com. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Great opportunity.
You're very welcome. My first question is, if you're elected, what are your priorities for the first 100 days at OSPI?
Yeah, we get this quite a bit, the first 100-day question, sort of emulating the White House. There's a slight difference, however, between what we do and that job. So first off, the person will be elected in November, and so when you think about this, they take office in about the second week of January, right as the legislature is taking up the most sort of powerful question we've had in decades in this state, how to fully fund McCleary. So for me, the first 100 days looks like a budget submission, quite frankly, and a set of policies for the governor and the legislature with my view of the world based on 30-plus thousand campaign miles and listening to people around the state, a bipartisan approach to how to possibly solve McCleary. And you parallel that with getting to know the organization more significantly and beginning to think about the structure of the organization and the way you want to deploy the resources there. So it's a two-part track. There's an immediate dive into the legislative process and trying to be a real partner in the budget solution for McCleary. Mm-hmm. And then there's really getting to know the organization and the agency and thinking long-term about how that ought to move forward.
Yeah, McCleary will certainly be front and center this legislative session coming up. Now, it's probably going to take billions of dollars to fully fund our education system, and we as LEV suspect that a few billion will trickle in over the next few years. At least that's the best case scenario. Where will the money best be spent, and how would you ensure that the money gets there?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and I appreciate that folks aren't trying to oversimplify this thing. A, it's hard to come up with that resource, and that's assuming some stable economic times. We're on one of the longest economic growth periods of our state's history without a recession, so we also have to think about the what-if of an economic downturn. How will we still sustain education funding? I say we ought not promote this process as needing the perfect.
Mm-hmm.
If everything comes together, that's probably not a realistic plan. You need to do something else. As far as a priority for the money, I think one thing we've learned is that the way we rely so aggressively on local school levies is creating very disparate opportunities for kids. So in a world where the state legislature steps up and fully funds basic education, they have to think differently about who the winners and losers have been for the last 30 or 40 years. Where is the need? Where do we see student achievement gaps as the greatest opportunity? And then begin to move dollars more effectively that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of communities in this state that have had very historic barriers to success due to systemic problems in the system, our tribal communities, our African-American communities, our Latino, Latina students. Quite frankly, our LGBTQ students are facing enormous barriers in their lives and need additional assistance, our foster care students. When you think about it not as just funding formulas and put more money in the system, but having the money actually follow where the students are, it causes you to think about data in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
So from the way the federal government has rewritten No Child Left Behind to the Opportunity Gap bill that I helped push through the legislature last year, both of those take a very serious data approach. And it says, listen, you no longer get credit for just improving your graduation rates. We want to know how it's going for subpopulations. We want to know about your students with disabilities, your special education students, your students of color. And when you start looking at the data and you really break this down by school district, it becomes very clear where the money has to go.
Okay.
And the legislature will need to find the courage and a statewide conversation about allowing resources to get to the most vulnerable students in the most vulnerable communities instead of sort of peanut buttering it for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you think OSPI can get involved here? How can you dig in?
Yeah, that's the awesomeness of this. For the last 14 years, I've been in the community and technical college system at the executive level and doing similar work to make data come alive. It's got to be more than just numbers. It's got to be policy and research. And so one of the roles of OSPI is to be the go-to place for the policymakers, whether it's the governor or the House and the Senate, to say, listen, let's really take a deep dive into the data. Let us be the experts in data. We're collecting it from the 295 school districts already. We should have competency in this work. We should be able to tell you what's working, what isn't working by geography, by student populations, by program. That's the role of OSPI, just a really professional organization that is empowering decision makers with data and research.
Okay. And then based on that data and research, that would help inform which programs need funding? Is that how you see that going down?
It's a far better system than sort of putting your finger in the air and testing the political winds on where money should go. So we've done that for a few decades. Now I think we ought to use data and research.
Yeah, you mentioned data, and I think about how there's a lot of people who are leery of data, especially testing, for example. I mean, that's a four-letter word for a lot of people. If we get rid of statewide testing, as many people have proposed, how will you measure the achievement gap?
Yeah, so we have better standards than we've had for a long time in this state, and they need constant work. I think of them as a living document. But from those standards, you derive an assessment system that ought to inform us. It ought to tell us whether the state's getting better, whether our districts are improving, whether populations of students are improving. So assessment becomes a very important part of the overall evaluation and data system. I think people don't necessarily worry about testing in the context of figuring out whether we're making progress. They get very nervous when you say there is a single test in the way of a student's graduation.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they get nervous, and that's where I put some energy in the last couple of years to say, hey, let's keep the assessments, let's improve them where they need help. But then let's make sure students have different ways to demonstrate proficiency. So you're excellent at showing your geometry skills through a standardized test, and maybe I'm not so good at that, but boy, can I build a house for you in a construction trades program where I have to demonstrate math competencies and I have to demonstrate geometry skills in an applied way. That's exactly what our employers are telling us we need to do.
Yeah.
Get these critical thinking students to demonstrate their abilities through their hands at times. If that's the way some students demonstrate, then let's give them that chance. Let's not make everybody have to pass the standardized test. Let's keep the standards high and the expectations high, but let's give them multiple ways to demonstrate it.
Do you think there's a way that there could be at least a replicable way to test people that's not the standard testing method?
Well, I think the standard method's going to stay. I mean, I don't see the feds backing off of that. I don't see the state backing off of that. So you're going to assess students. The question is, what happens then? What happens when you make it by a point? I miss it by 1 point. You get a high school diploma and I have to flush 13 or 12 years of education down the drain? I don't think so. So the question becomes, what is the alternative? Do we put you in a collection of evidence class where you come up with a portfolio and sort of prove that you know it? Or do we rely on these really robust courses we've built that are aligned between colleges and our K-12 system that allow students to really dive into the standards in a course-based setting, pass the course, meet the standards, graduate on time? It's really about the alternatives more than it is about throwing everything away.
And you think that we can maintain the rigor then that way?
I do. I absolutely do. We're leading the country right now in what we call these bridge courses. We've got private partners and nonprofit partners and K-12 system. Our K-12 and higher ed faculty have worked on these. The standards are good. It's hard work. And part of it is, as you well know, getting people trained up. So if you ask them to teach a more rigorous course as an alternative to a test, you got to do the professional development. More than 100 high schools right now, I believe, about 7,000 students taking these courses. It's just been incredible, but we got a ways to go.
In some school districts, as a response to the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, they have discontinued paying for after-school tutoring. How would you and OSPI hold yourselves accountable to families and communities through ESSA implementation?
Yeah, so this is one of those things where if you really look at the purpose of our federal statute, it's obviously to improve student achievement and hopefully without too much of the federal government telling us exactly what to do. But when we look at the data, back to that question, these programs make a huge difference. So in a world where we're going to add $3 or $3.5 billion to fully solve McCleary, rather than just putting it in the existing formulas, let's use that research and data to figure out what that best investment looks like. And for a lot of students, it's before school programs, it's after school programs. Quite frankly, it's summer interventions, avoiding the summer learning loss, avoiding the social emotional support that some students get during the school year. These kinds of things become the substance of a new vision for schools that has the money following the need and being very creative about the school day and the length of the school year.
And how would you get input from the families and communities to make sure that they're on board?
Well, obviously, we don't want anything to run out of Olympia. So you have a relationship with 295 districts, and you create systemic ways for those districts to get input and feedback from families about what's needed. And then when the need is there, you work hard with policymakers to get the money to follow the need.
Mm-hmm. Would you have more community forums? Would you do something like that?
You got to do that. I mean, you got to do that from the state level. You got to do that in the local community level. You have to listen to experts in the field and providers who aren't necessarily in our schools. So, you know, I feel very confident, having spent my career in education, listening to the experts who deploy it. But increasingly, we're asking for nonprofit community partners to do some of the stuff that, quite frankly, the schools are not expert in. You got to bring those folks in, too. They know that after-school world. They know that tutor world, that childcare world. They are the ones who have, in some cases, created whole organizations around this topic, and we definitely want them accountable, but they got to be at the table.
Yeah, and in the schools, it seems like a lot of the people doing the work are paraeducators or instructional assistants. What would you want to do with those folks to ramp them up, if anything?
Yeah, well, we've got to increase their professional development plan. So they've got to share in a larger amount of professional development. Now, that doesn't mean we take away from certificated teachers. Quite frankly, the state's walked away from too much of this. The state has to invest in professional development, but it's got to land not just on the classroom teacher, the certificated teacher, but also on our paraeducators. And when it comes to things like cultural competence and really understanding equity issues, that's got to hit the whole staff. Your custodian, your principal, your school board members, your teachers, your cafeteria workers, your bus drivers, everybody needs professional development in that world. So part of it for our paras is making sure there's a career ladder for them, mm-hmm. that they have a clear understanding that if they make progress and they're successful and they get good evaluations, they know their education plan and they know their professional growth plan in case they want to do something more with their profession. And that isn't abundantly clear yet. I think in some ways healthcare has done a better job creating these career ladders for folks. And it's something that education has to learn from.
Yeah, where do you think we'd find more paras and people to help out in the classroom? Because it seems like there's such a need.
Well, there is a need. I think there's a lot there already. I think being flexible about the way we recruit and retain folks, being very intentional about marketing this opportunity to communities. I sat with a community group recently, and it was just incredible. A lot of second language learners. And what they said is the school is reaching out. They want to help. They're asking us to be involved as parents. But then when we kind of uncover what's there at the school, it isn't a lot of folks who look like us, and it isn't folks who are native speakers like we are. And so they're saying, you know, use us. Don't just bring us in as parents kind of advocating for our kids. Make us the paraeducators. Give us that opportunity to be the teacher support system along with our certificated staff. We have the language. We have the cultural relevancy with our own kids. It's a beautiful and perfect idea.
Yeah.
With the right resources, I think you will see school districts expand that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned the idea of educators not necessarily reflecting their communities. Is there a way to help rectify that so that teachers really can reflect the students that they're serving?
I do believe there is. It's a long-term question and answer. So you have a teaching corps that's very passionate and very good right now that's going to need professional development. You can't really instantly recruit the equity and diversity lens that is necessary in our schools. So you have to teach and train those who are there while at the same time you create very different incentives than we've had in the past to get folks to teach. What will it take to tell a young man of color graduating from a high school today, we want you back here in 4 or 5 years teaching in our schools? What will it take? Well, I've talked to a lot of them after 30,000 campaign miles, and I'll tell you, they say it's got to be good compensation, and at $36,000 to $40,000 a year, that's okay, but it's not great in light of the student loan debt crisis that's building. They're picking other opportunities. They want to know that it's valued, and so I think there's some mixed messages about that. We know how critical this time is for education. We don't always say the words that I think we should say, which is it's a critical time to have great teachers. And to recruit great teachers. So they got to know there's a level of respect there. And of course, people who teach want to do it because they love kids and they love their content. And those two worlds have to come together with enough flexibility that you just feel energized. When you hit a home run in a classroom teaching a lesson, you feel it. It's very real. Mm. And kids connect and that bell rings and they're still sitting there and they want more. If the system gets too mechanized and too rote and you take away that creativity for kids or teachers, folks won't pick the profession. So it's all of the above. Real good resources to recruit them, support in some cases when they get there, obviously keeping it creative and flexible, and then ongoing professional development. All of us want to get better at what we do over time. So just going through a teacher prep program and sticking someone in a classroom and saying you're good to go, that's not going to work.
Yeah. When you were a teacher, how much flexibility did you have?
You know, that's another fascinating thing. I had a lot because I was a social studies teacher. Mm. And we ought to think about this. Why is it that the math, science and English language arts folks are getting, you know, sort of a narrower approach to teaching and learning Where social studies teachers like myself or even health educators or some other folks in different subjects, they're still sort of maintaining a lot of flexibility. We still have standards, but getting there is still a great opportunity for teachers to figure out. We ought to find a happy medium in all those worlds where our math and science and English language arts teachers are still having flexibility and our social studies teacher are still held to some pretty good standards.
Mm-hmm. When you were the social studies teacher, what was the most innovative thing that you did?
You know, I kind of scrapped the textbook in many ways during my second year of teaching, and I got sophisticated enough to go find additional resources, which wasn't always easy. And then I created games. I created interactive learning. So we built a game where we were able to replicate the stock market crash before my students realized they were in the middle of the stock market crash.
Which one, 2008 or 1929?
29. So this was a lesson in sort of what is the natural evolution of markets when you don't have some good stop valves and some good mechanisms. And so that's the kind of stuff that I loved. And the second thing I did is I taught from an age culture perspective. Rather than teaching them wars and dates and presidents, I tried to give them every decade of history through the eyes of somebody their age. Hmm. So what was a 14 or 15-year-old doing in the post-Civil War, in the 1920s and the 1940s? We looked at culture, music, art, all of it. And that was awesome. Kids connected with that.
Yeah. Is there any way to somehow replicate that? Jeez, I wish I had that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope that some of my colleagues are still doing that. I know there's some pretty amazing social studies teachers making that connection, you know. But you still got to meet standards. You still want kids to know the basic causes of things in the world and in our history. But you can do it in a way that hooks them in.
Yeah, connecting with kids is certainly key. And data can show when rigor is there. You've certainly talked a lot about that. OSPI, as you probably know, has collected a wealth of valuable information and has significantly increased the accessibility of it all. But how can OSPI leverage all this data to improve student outcomes and really improve the trust and the understanding that the public has of this data?
For me, that is the vision for the next 4 years, is transforming it from a place that has a lot of data, which means districts sometimes feel it's a very regulatory organization, that it's there to say no more than it is to say, hey, yes, what's possible? How can we be creative? And part of that's because they're collecting so much data and there's so many boxes to check and so much paperwork to fill out. So streamlining that so we collect what's absolutely necessary. And then instead of just putting the data on websites for people to sort of navigate whether they've got that sophistication or not, actually turning it into really actionable research. Hiring people like PhDs who do actual research to say, this is what the data tells us is working, isn't working, and turning that into policy papers so that when you go to the legislature and the public, you can say, this isn't just some latest, greatest idea from an elected superintendent or somebody in the office. This is what our student performance is telling us works and doesn't work, and here's how we can get better. I truly feel like the State Board for Community and Technical Colleges is a model of this. They've transformed themselves from a great data organization to a data and research organization. And today, they bring the best and most creative ideas to the legislature on what to do next. And the country has figured it out. They're looking at us in this state the way that we are transforming basic education in our colleges, mm-hmm. our pre-college work, the way we're integrating technical learning with language skills, the way that we're paying, in some cases, colleges for their results, not just their inputs. All of that came from the research agenda at the college system, not waiting for elected officials to tell them what to do, but saying, hey, we're the experts in this. Let's take control of our destiny and do the right thing for students.
Mm. How do you feel about infographics? So with something like that,
I love it. I mean, those are important tools. They really are important tools. The fact that you mentioned that as a particular tool tells you that we don't change in our lives about being diverse learners. People need different things. Some mm-hmm. people you can say, hey, here's a database, start combing through it. Others need to read it. Others need to see it. Others need a forum in their community. Others need a webinar. Those kinds of tools that reach out to the citizens and pull them into their school system and say, you own this. This is your system. You're paying for it. Your kids and grandkids are in it. That's what engages folks to say, okay, how do I help? What can I do differently? And so I love that you brought up infographics because it's a learning style issue. And if we're really good citizens and good modelers for our kids and their different learning styles, we ought to do that for the adults in the system as well.
Last question for you. What frightens you most about the idea of taking over OSPI?
Time. Mm. Time. You know, these are four-year terms, and you sort of sit back and imagine all of the professional sort of development I've done in my life in the 20 years in education at K-12 and higher ed and policymaking. There is so much that I see we can do, and I just can't imagine getting to half of it in 48 months or what is the sort of initial set of priority after that first wave of budget and that first wave of evaluating the organization, you know, what will emerge? These things take a lot of time. We did not get here overnight, and we won't get out of this overnight. So it's intimidating to think about how much I would love to do to transform the system for kids and parents and make it stronger, and knowing, you know, there's only so many breaths in a day. It's so many hours, so much time. And I have a young family, you know. I'd be the first superintendent, if elected, to actually have kids in public school at the time of service. I've got a kid going into middle school. I mean, we're as nervous as any parent putting a kid in seventh grade. I've got a fifth grader as well. And so balancing the time of being dad and husband and community person with this big role is a little terrifying, but it's part of the deal.
Yeah, how would you do that?
It's like all of us. We put our best foot forward, and we build a culture in our family about expectation. My kids know that I love them deeply and that I care about their success, but I've got a world that I live in where I'm also trying to help other kids. And they're pretty amazing about that. They did a lot of campaign time this year with Dad in the car, so they're getting pretty used to this.
Are you giving them, like, video game time or
not a lot of that? Not a lot of that. A little bit. Not much of that. The ice cream is usually the trick. Yeah. Ice cream is usually the good, you know, bribe to keep them pleased about the next 1,000 miles.
Chris Reykdal is a candidate for the Superintendent of Public Instruction. More info at chrisreykdal.com, spelled R-E-Y-K-D-A-L, chrisreykdal.com. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.